So with our mindfulness practice, we're okay with going slow or fast. We'll go around the perimeter of the room and we'll go slowly. So it'll be a little bit of standing meditation will happen as we wait for other people to join the procession. But the intention is to increase the mindfulness of the body. And of course we walk every day and we walked in the room and somehow that walking was not meditation, perhaps. Maybe it was. I don't know. So this is a special time that we can calmly and in a very relaxed way enjoy the feeling of the feet touching the floor in a very nice space here. A lot of sacred imagery and a lot of friends. So this is a special opportunity to practice mindfulness of walking here. And we'll do this for about 30 or 40 minutes. So it's actually good exercise in that sense. Helps get the chi flowing a little bit as well. So we're probably going to be moving slow enough where you can follow your breath as you walk, but just usually point out that that's not a requirement. It's okay to do walking meditation with just feeling the sensation of the feet touching the floor without being concerned really about whether the breath is coming in or out. But it is possible to also kind of sync up the right foot and left foot with the in and out breathing. So in this case, we'll just try to keep what movement we can keep going with the large group around the room and just mostly focusing on the sensation of the feet touching the floor, but also being aware of those of us that are entering the line or just that general awareness of the chairs, the carpet is uneven at times. So we're aware of our surroundings as well as aware of that sensation of the feet touching the floor. So as we attempt to inch forward little by little, feeling the sensation of the heel touching the ground, feeling the toes, moving forward little by little, directing the attention to the feet and away from thoughts. Focusing on the sensations of the feet touching the floor, whether standing or walking. Our hands can be in front of our body. Our posture is not rigid, but erect and mindful. Energy flows through the body as the breath comes in and out. Whether sitting, standing, or walking, we're aware of the feelings of the body in whatever position it's disposed. In general, our eyes are downcast, not looking around the room, but still aware of our surroundings as our body moves through space. We can stand still, aware of the sensations in the body. As we conclude this meditation, we can end with the intention, may all beings be freed of all suffering. Please be seated. One of the traditional functions of the monastic in the monastery is to conduct the ceremony of giving the five precepts to those who are interested in that. Taking the refuges and precepts is very much a bread and butter basic Buddhist ceremony. And even if one has done this before, it never hurts to review or to reaffirm. And of course, this is mostly about our intentions. The role of the monk who's doing the ceremony is, of course, just helping facilitate this. The real action happens inside the mind. Of course, we can't ever force someone else to change or do something, but to inspire or motivate. The Buddha regularly taught about these five precepts as a foundation for human existence. And there's a number of senior teachers. I've heard it's not impossible to say that this is really the essence of true human existence, following the five precepts. For example, not taking life of other living creatures intentionally. Whenever other humans or animals or beings we can't see come in contact with us, they feel safe because they know that we don't want to hurt them. And we give the gift of fearlessness. And that's just the beginning of the five precepts. But of course, in a Judeo-Christian culture, more or less, as I at least view America, the canvas or backdrop pretty much comes from the views of Western religion. I think that something that a number of Eastern practitioners don't, at least in Thailand, a number of the monks don't really have a kind of a guilt complex, or kind of if they make mistakes, they don't necessarily, it doesn't mean they don't have remorse or they don't notice if there's some sort of challenge that needs to be addressed or something needs to be corrected, but the amount of like self-punishment or internal, I think punishment's a good word, but that action of guilt, almost like a self-hatred, that isn't there. It's actually changing now. One of the unfortunate aspects of globalization as many folks are encouraged to become more westernized and to gain, say, more materialistic things. Basically, a lot of these kind of views start to creep in, and so now there's the English word guilty has come into the Thai language. Whether we make mistakes or not with the five precepts, we're still going to have to, of course, deal with our minds and how we relate to these. But they're precepts; they're not commandments. They're very much a guide for living. And if we ever make mistakes, then what the Buddha mostly wanted was awareness of those mistakes, so that we can analyze that, we can feel that, and notice whatever it is that we'd like to change in our life. So without further ado, starting on page 17, there's a call and response format for the three refuges, and then the five precepts, which are both in Pali and then in English. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sarna kamanang nititang pahanati pata verapani sikapatang samadhiyami. Here's the important part, the English, because we know what it means. Okay. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. Adinadana viramani sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. Kame sumichachara viramani sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. Musavada viramani sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from false and harmful speech. Sura merya maja pamadatana viramani sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from intoxicating drinks and drugs which lead to carelessness. Im mani pancha sikha patani samadhyami silena sukatinyanti silena boga sampada silena nibutinyanti tasama silang visohotaye. Sadhu. All right, very good. So my name is Ajahn Guna. That's my Buddhist name. My name was David before. It's still in my passport. If I ever go to the airport, they look at that. U.S. government knows me as David. David used to sit back there, kind of where you're sitting. He came once in the late 90s, and so part of the path of Buddhism here in the Bay Area. James thought it'd be maybe interesting to, he said I could share some about my path, so I was thinking, okay, well, so just going back a bit before David was there, kind of in the back row on Thursday night, I was born in Indiana lived in a small town called Wheatfield, and that's the real name. People say, really, is that, that's the real name? You're not just making that up. No, it's real. But I mostly saw corn. I didn't really see any wheat. Outside of my bedroom window, it was big, cornfield. And anyway, I mean, there was just no Buddhism in sight. Needless to say. So here and there, I went to some Protestant churches, some Catholic churches, mostly under duress. I fainted here. I threw up there. I think there was a reaction. Funny enough, later, I see where my life is going. But I started playing piano when I was 5 and spent almost 20 years practicing piano, playing jazz piano, and eventually went to music school at a place called Berklee School of Music, which is in Boston, which was interesting for me because when I was 13, I moved to Palo Alto and then went to middle school, high school in Palo Alto, and then had the chance to study on the East Coast and never lived there before. So it's always interesting, of course, traveling and learning from those experiences of being out of your comfort zone. And then my grandfather died, and I was about 20 years old, and that was very sudden. He was still farming back in Indiana, and he ate health food, and he was out there working and, pretty muscular, kind of in shape kind of person, working the land, very successful, hardworking person. And basically it was, he was about 69 and he wanted to pass the farm on to one of the other members of the family, but no one else was willing to take on the commitment. It was a lot of work. And not long after that, he just, boop, just passed away in his living room. But that sudden change of, something that I wasn't expecting to that degree, because I was close to my grandfather, that very much threw me into a question about life, very much a question about what I was doing with my life and how long does life go on, What am I doing? Is this, do I really want to be playing jazz piano? But I was still kind of halfway through my degree, so I couldn't really let myself think too much about it. But I was influenced enough to pick an elective, because most of the degree was playing music, but then you still had to kind of do a bit of math and English in this. And so I had to take this elective, and I picked Eastern philosophy. There I actually read the Word of the Buddha. That was the first time, and I felt an immediate connection, because I read about Hinduism and Taoism, and this was all part of the class, and there were parts of that I liked parts of it, but there was always something where I didn't feel convinced, or I didn't really have faith or trust, confidence, so forth. But when I read the Word of the Buddha, then immediately there's this kind of resonance. So then I started looking for meditation groups. I found an Insight Meditation Center in Cambridge, learned a bit about walking, sitting meditation, went to a Zen, Korean Zen place in Cambridge as well. Finally graduated, went to my kind of dream spot in Manhattan, and kind of started living the jazz life. And it didn't take long. I noticed, oh, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. So a lot of going to smoky bars and walking through strange neighborhoods at odd hours, and the whole scene around it was not inspiring me. And I was starting to also read this book called A Path with Heart, which some of you may have heard of. It's kind of interesting. A couple of years ago, I had the chance to go to the family retreat at Spirit Rock, and I mentioned that I read The Path with Heart, and one of the young girls was, "Who's Jack Kornfield?" I said, "You don't know?" But you know, so I don't have to explain. But there's this part in the book about finding a teacher, and there was this quote of my teacher, Ajahn Chah. And so I was very moved by that chapter about finding a teacher. And I thought, you know, this is really important. This is really right. So what am I doing here in Manhattan? So I decided to go back to California and start looking for basically a place to ordain or a teacher. So I went to a number of places, and people at Berkeley Buddhist Monastery actually showed me to their main monastery at City of 10,000 Buddhas, which was very nice. And then we went to this place called Abayagiri. And, of course, they're very organized there, and they sent me this kind of list of rules before I arrived, and something about not playing music and not listening or playing music. The seventh precept of the eight is a renunciant precept. It's not a moral precept, but refraining from scents, garlands, basically perfume, necklaces, adornments, but also entertainment and music, so forth. So I didn't really understand how that got in the list, because, you know, like killing people, stealing, you know, it's like kind of your mother already taught you, you know, these things long ago. So that didn't make much sense. But I thought, well, you know, it's only a week. You know, I can do that for a week. So anyway, a week turned into many months, and then I actually was quite inspired by the Dhamma talks that Ajahn Pasno gave about his time in Thailand. So I decided to go and ordain in Thailand, and so I did that at the International Monastery with the ordination at the Wat Nong Bapong, which is Ajahn Chah's monastery. And then I spent 10 years in Thailand, living in the various monasteries of the Ajahn Chah tradition. Somewhere in the forest near the border of Burma, very remote with malaria, and luckily I didn't get malaria, but I admit I was pretty afraid of getting malaria, at least in the beginning. There they have malaria that goes to the brain as well as the kind that hides in the liver. And you want to catch that before it progresses, of course. And I saw a number of friends carried out. None of those monks passed away, but there were certainly some touch and go moments. But there's another place on the border of Laos, which was very beautiful, overlooking the Mekong River, very picturesque. And of course, the northeast of Thailand is kind of the farm country. So being born in the Midwest and then kind of going to this section of northeastern Thailand, it's very much their area of rice farming. And basically life is simple compared to the big city in Bangkok. And the highest, say, number of enlightened beings basically came from that area of the northeast of Thailand, Ajahn Chah being one of them. And then one of his teachers, Lumpu Mun. So there was very much an aspect of austerity that was just a part of daily life for these master teachers. Of course, as they got more famous, they could have lived a much more comfortable life if they wanted to, but they led by example, and they always kept things very simple. And this was very much a part of their teaching that they passed on to their students. So in 2009, I moved back to Abayagiri, and then about 7 months ago, I moved here. And so now I live here in Berkeley, and I have a good opportunity to also visit my grandmother, who now lives in Mountain View. She moved from the Midwest, and she really likes it here. The weather is much better. I mean, it's unbelievable that this is winter. A bit scary, actually, as far as global climate change and so forth. But so I have opportunities to visit her, and she's about 85, so it's a good time to visit. And I encourage her to start a meditation group at her home, and she's now doing that on Fridays. So that's very, very nice. So sometimes when I kind of add that on to going to a meditation group at Stanford University, and that's in Palo Alto, so Mountain View's nearby, of course, and there's a place in Fremont called Wapudanasan. It's a Thai monastery, and we have some Tuesday meetings there and so forth. And then on Sundays, I've been doing a Dhamma Media and Modern Issues class here, which is an intention to bring more awareness to modern issues, but to also basically show people that the Buddha was talking a lot about these things 2,600 years ago. And also, there's a way to bring meditation practice, and there's a way to work with the anxiety that is very natural. It comes up when looking at a number of modern issues, and we do walking meditation, the aspect of body awareness that's also taught, because a lot of times nowadays when we're looking at all these various screens, whether it's big or small, phones or whatever, there's a kind of getting absorbed into that, which is not mindful, or not the absorption of, say, sama samadhi. So just getting back into the body and encouraging health is a part of that. So living here has been very nice, and in general, things go very well. One thing that happened the other day, though, that was kind of disturbing, there was this this strange guy who was, like, trying all the doors, the monastery, trying to get in, and was very kind of creepy and kind of wearing a trench coat and was very kind of off-balanced. And anyway, interesting to note, there's six doors in the monastery. There's two exits here. There's the two doors out front that we go in and out, and there by the dining room, the kitchen, all kind of total six doors. And I was later thinking, six doors. It kind of reminds me of a sutta. The Buddha talks about the sense doors and what comes into the mind and what do we do with that. Is it wholesome? Is it unwholesome? Do we allow just anything to come in the mind, or do we not want certain things to come in the mind? And of course, there's a lot of things we don't want to have come in the mind. And when certain mind states do come in the mind, there are many ways to deal with them, but many times we don't notice they're operating. I mentioned guilt earlier. That's definitely something worth flagging. And I think for a Western audience, it's probably one of the main things to talk about. But of course, the Buddha identified greed, hatred, and delusion as the three root defilements to be on the lookout for. And there are some quotes in the Dhammapada, some of which I thought would be nice to read tonight, about this. Here, number 40, realizing that this body is as fragile as a clay pot, and fortifying this mind like a well-fortified city, fight out Mara with the sword of wisdom, then guarding the conquest, remain unattached. Number 36, wisdom never becomes perfect in one whose mind is not steadfast, who knows not the good teaching, and whose faith wavers. 37. Dwelling in the cave of the heart, the mind without form wanders far and alone. Those who subdue this mind are liberated from the bonds of Mara. 'Wonderful indeed it is to subdue the mind, so difficult to subdue, ever swift, and seizing whatever it desires. A tamed mind brings happiness.' Let the discerning one guard the mind, so difficult to detect and extremely subtle, seizing whatever it desires. A guarded mind brings happiness. Just as a fletcher straightens an arrow shaft, even so the discerning one straightens their mind. So fickle and unsteady, so difficult to guard and control. It's interesting to reflect how many lives the Buddha must have dealt with a mind thinking about this and that, or maybe worried about, well, everything. Restlessness, doubt. He endured so much, and yet he was able to overcome all that. It's really a great inspiration to think that it is possible. And whenever we do have some progress in our practice, it's an indication that this is possible. But what is practice? This is something that the Buddha spoke about in length, but in short, the Eightfold Path is a good reference point. And this aspect of the six sense doors and guarding what comes in and out of the mind, he spoke about this in the Anguttara Nikaya. And he said, just as the royal frontier fortress has a gatekeeper, wise, experienced, intelligent, to keep out those he doesn't know and to let in those he does, for the protection of those within and to ward off those without. In the same way, a disciple of the noble ones is mindful, highly meticulous, remembering, and able to call to mind even things that were done and said long ago. With mindfulness as his gatekeeper, the disciple of the noble ones abandons what is unskillful, develops what is skillful, abandons what is blameworthy, develops what is blameless, and looks after himself with purity. And a quote from Ajahn Jeff. As an exercise in keeping one frame of reference in mind, try going through the day and relating all your experiences to how they affect the breath energy in the body, or how the breath affects them. In other words, when you wake up, how does your breath energy feel? When you're talking with other people, how do your remarks and their remarks affect the breath energy? Bring your experience of the breath energy in the body into all your activities so that it provides the basic frame of reference that you try to stay sensitive to throughout the day. See what effects this has on your powers of mindfulness and concentration when you sit to meditate. There is a tendency to equate Satipatthana practice with the process of simply noting events, physical sensations, feelings, mind states, and mental qualities as they arise and pass away. Trying to maintain an attitude of non-reactivity in the face of whatever, positive or negative, comes up in your awareness. Actually, though, non-reactivity is an aspect of equanimity. And although equanimity is one of the qualities developed in Satipatthana practice, mindfulness is not non-reactive awareness. In the Pali Suttas, mindfulness, sati, means the ability to keep something in mind. And in the practice, it specifically means the ability to keep the project of developing skillfulness and abandoning unskillfulness in mind. In Majjhima Nikaya number 117, for instance, the role of right mindfulness is to keep remembering to abandon the factors of the wrong path, such as wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and to develop the factors of the right path. The discourses often compare mindfulness to a wise gatekeeper who knows who to let into a fortress and who not. Thus, mindfulness, instead of being a non-judging state of mind, is a basic factor in the wise exercise of judgment. Mindfulness is often paired with sampajanya, which has been translated as clear comprehension, full awareness, or alertness. In the passages where sampajanya is described in action, it means the ability to be alert to what you are doing, and by extension, the results of your actions. Satipatthana, literally, the establishing of mindfulness, is a process whereby one keeps a frame of reference in mind, the body, in and of itself, feelings in and of themselves, etc., and then makes a steady effort to be alert to what one is doing in relation to that frame of reference. So easier said than done. I think it's also good to have a sense of humor and kind of laugh a bit when something falls or something happens. But also just being honest about what's happening. And that can be difficult because we've spent lifetimes trying to kind of cover up some stories or some facts, as humans do. That's nature. That's the job of delusion. So delusion is doing a great job when that happens. Anger, it's really easy to be annoyed. Just a little bit of kind of, I don't like that, kind of being annoyed. That's anger, as well as really kind of getting red in the face and throwing stuff and that kind of extreme of anger. But desire can be gross or subtle. And there's usually a lot of justification that Mara tries to put out there to say, well, it's okay, you know, it's okay to have kind of another piece of pie or whatever it is. And desires can, of course, get us in trouble and bring us out of balance. I guess I read that currently in the United States, about 80% of those who are trying to get into the military are denied because of obesity, criminal record, and failing to complete high school. Those three reasons. And it's by some considered a issue of, you know, national security. There's a kind of fear that America won't be able to defend itself. I'm not at all proposing or encouraging war, but it's of course interesting when you get kind of the generals starting to talk about, you know, health and dietary issues. But as far as what the Buddha had to say about that, he talked about bhojane matanyuta, about eating the right amount. And of course, eating can be, you know, whatever kind of sandwiches, ice cream, whatever it is people eat. But on a deeper level, it's what we're taking in the sense doors, those six doors that are in the fortress. And as to what we want to let in, what we want to let out, it's also inspiring to think about what we want to let in, what we want to attract into our city or into our mind. And then also to know that we actually have control of that. We actually have more control of this than we think. And this is one of the very inspiring facts of Buddhism, is that since we're the owners of our karma, we're empowered to make our future. We're empowered to do what we want. But this is a different kind of freedom than what is usually popularized in America, of kind of various kind of freedom it's an interesting topic, and these words have to be defined, but the kind of the freedom to pursue sense desire to the point of hurting oneself and others is certainly something that needs to be evaluated as a practitioner. And there's, of course, many things where one can be kind of a you know, quote-unquote good citizen and perhaps not be breaking obvious kind of legal codes, but still hurting oneself or hurting others. In that ceremony we did earlier about the five precepts, these are the qualities that we want to invite into our city or into our mind. For example, refraining from drugs and alcohol. I mean, if someone wants to drink a case of beer at their living room and crash out, the police are not going to come by and bother them. That's kind of like their right, so to speak. But of course, the mind is clouded, to say the least. So anyway, I think it's very inspiring to know that we have more ability to change things for the better than we usually are giving ourselves credit for, and certainly more so than we're told by the kind of general messages we get through Hollywood or the internet or whatnot. So being as clear as possible with ourselves as to what our goals are, what we want to do with our life. And then when I reflect, say, on my grandfather, just suddenly dying at 69, who's to say that we're going to live till we're 100 years old or whatever it is? And I mean, sometimes I find it interesting, like, in a, say there's such a big, crowd of people here, how many people actually know someone who's over 100 years old? So there's a few hands up. And so how old are they? 102, all right. 104, okay. 101, 102, okay. 116. Okay, she's still alive. So do we know anyone who's like 120, 130, 150? I don't. But basically, if we even just kind of, just to save all argument, we just say, okay, 100. Okay, we'll just say, okay, we're all going to live till we're 100 years old. Just say. So how many more years is that? So we can think, okay. So this is sometimes a good exercise to do, because we can also think about, that example of, say, my grandfather at 69, Okay, what if it was 69? Some are over that already. Some are not. Of course, the truth is we don't know. The Buddha said that impermanence is the quality of all things except nibbana. So this is not kind of a teaching to get everyone depressed or something, but it's actually a way of making one's life happier through really valuing the time that we have, valuing the relationships that we have with people, noticing that people are doing good things around us. People are helping us in various ways. People are teaching us things maybe in certain ways. There's a lot going on that we probably think that, well, it's not so special. I'll kind of check up on that later. And as if there's a later. And so it's quite helpful to contemplate that once in a while and to think, well, what am I doing with my time? And at least for myself, I made kind of a drastic change in my life, I guess you could say. It's very individual, and we all have karma. We've all, from a Buddhist point of view, we've all lived many, many, many lifetimes, and we've created various good and bad karma, and of course it's usually mixed, and we're right now receiving the fruits of that, and some of these things are bearing fruit in this very life, and other things we don't, we have no clue what's kind of coming up later in the story. But the thing that's of course, special with Buddhism is that it's not deterministic, is that we have the ability now, right in the present moment, to make changes if we want. And that's the key, is what do we want? And this is a kind of desire that's actually wholesome, is chanda, having the desire to do wholesome things, whatever that is, helping others. There was mention of dana earlier. There's many ways to be generous also that are nothing to do with money. There's ways that we can be of service to others, ways we can listen to those who have problems, not just like other people out there, but we can listen to ourselves as well. There's many ways to benefit society. And then there's the practice of virtue, which we took the five precepts. And then there's mental cultivation, which is not just sitting meditation. Of course, that's important. There's mindfulness of walking, standing, lying down. But many ways to cultivate mental qualities, such as faith or such as energy. Bringing energy, it's kind of difficult late at night to bring up much energy, but you watch some people watching kind of some Super Bowl thing and they're kind of suddenly alive, you know, and it's, you know, what hour is it, you know, and you catch them kind of at 7 p.m. somewhere else and they're not so alive. So what is it that we are interested in? What really makes us alive? This is very much a part of that empowering practice that we're all trying to understand. And the more that we can see our habits, and the more that we can see whatever direction we're going in, and the more that we can be in tune with what goals we want to have, we can see whether we're on the course that we want to be on or not. And sometimes, there's some pain there if it's not what we want. But that can be very valuable to look at if it's there, to whatever degree. But if we feel that we're going in the direction that we want to be going, then we can also put more energy into that. Just as if one's farming or planting a garden can have the fertilizer, the rain, the sun, the right conditions to grow the beautiful flowers that we want to have. So, guarding the mind, looking at what we allow in, what we consume, what kind of food from the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. It's coming in. And not hating that, not being worried about that, but not only being aware of that, but also, as Ajahn Jeff pointed out in his teaching, that quality of being active in mindfulness practice and actively removing or dealing with whatever it is that we need to deal with so that we can continue on with our goals of whatever wholesome work that we want to do. And this is our chance. Here we are. Human rebirth, apparently very, very difficult to obtain. Every 100 years, or how did the Buddha put it? A blind turtle in the great sea is kind of meandering around, and the chances of him popping up to the surface and popping his head up through this kind of bamboo ring that's floating out there, just kind of willy-nilly, kind of out on the great sea, the chances of that blind turtle putting his head up through that bamboo ring is the chances that we have for a human birth. That's how rare it is to be be reborn as a human. And so the Buddha said, this is a very great opportunity that we all have. And it's the kind of opportunity where in heaven realms, one is kind of living it up. They're kind of spending their spiritual bank account, and then they kind of get into debt and perhaps fall to hell realms. Human realm is a place where we can experience a certain amount of suffering, but also a certain amount of pleasure or happiness. And basically, it's a great place to learn. And that is perhaps also why the Buddha took his last birth here in the human realm and did what he had to do to become the Buddha. So to know that that potential is also the same potential that we have if we put in the right causes and conditions and we're careful about what we let into our mind and how we deal with it once it's in our mind. So this is a process. It's not something that just kind of happens overnight. Or I think some people, they come kind of new to Buddhism and they're sitting there and they're kind of hoping for some sort of lights or some sort of big kind of show or something, you know, and then they kind of go home and they're like, you know, oh darn, you know, it didn't work. Now here and there, some people actually do. There are stories of some really interesting, you almost want to call it beginner's luck, but since as Buddhists, we believe in rebirth, then you know it's not beginner's luck. Basically, that person's been practicing so many lifetimes, they just did the practice before and didn't remember it. But regardless of those kind of pizzazz experiences, very much the foundation of our practice needs to be solid, and very much the precepts, the dana of helping ourselves and other human beings in the world. This is foundational of the Buddhist teachings, because when we give of our time or whatever we have that we feel is ours, then we're giving up of our sense of self just a little bit. And that's difficult to do. But the practice is very worthwhile, and there's many inspiring examples still alive today. And on Sunday, we've invited Peter Dale Scott, who's a former professor of UC Berkeley, who's also lived in Thailand and practiced in Buddhist monasteries there. And we're having a conversation about globalization and spirituality. The focus of it is our experiences in Thailand, and he'll also be reading his poetry, which he's a poet and expert in many areas. He'll be here to also share his experience, which I think will be very interesting. So those are some reflections tonight, and I'd actually like to close with a chant on page 29, which is a chant of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. These are the qualities we want in our mind. So we can all chant together. May I abide in well-being, in freedom from affliction, in freedom from hostility, in freedom from ill will, in freedom from anxiety, and may I maintain well-being in myself. May everyone abide in well-being, in freedom from hostility, In freedom from ill will, in freedom from anxiety, and may they maintain well-being in themselves. May all beings be released from all suffering, and may they not be parted from the good fortune they have attained. When they act upon intention, all beings are the owners of their action and inherit its results. Their future is born from such action, companion to such action, and its results will be their home. All actions with intention, be they skillful or harmful, of such acts they will be the heirs. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.